Coming up today, our verdict on Microsoft's HoloLens VR headset, what to expect from Season 3 of Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror, and DeepMind does the impossible by successfully navigating London's underground network. You're listening to episode 289 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Victoria Wollaston.
Hello.
Matt Burgess, what did you learn this week?
I learned this week that there is now a historical archive of GIFs.
Okay.
The US National Archives has created a channel on Giphy where they've turned a load of their really old footage, like black and white stuff, all really weird things going on, into a sequence of GIFs.
Great, Reagan GIFs.
Yeah, any sort of historical GIF. There's probably some space GIFs in there if you want them.
My favourite GIF that you ever made, Matt Burgess, was of Eric from the Science Museum.
Eric the haunting robot.
Yeah,
he's pretty spooky. Vicky, what did you learn this week?
I learned that naked mole rats have evolved to not feel any pain.
Same. No.
So infant naked mole rats, they have the normal amount of pain sensors, but by the time they reach adulthood, they've learned sort of the limits of what keeps them safe and alive, and those sensors actually reduce by 2/3. Now, I love naked mole rats. I know I'm in the minority because they are very ugly, but they're amazing. I mean, they've developed biological defences against cancer. They live up to 32 years, and by comparison, a common brown rat only lives 2.
There's a lot to learn from the naked mole rat.
It's a coping mechanism for living in 2016, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, even the cancer defence would be very, very handy. Yeah, living 32 years less so.
Yeah.
Death would be near. I learned, and I'm completely chickening out here, I forgot to look up something or learn anything this week, seemingly. It's possible to spend £50 on a pair of hiking socks.
What?
Yeah.
What sort of socks? Are they comfy?
They're entirely waterproof and have like funny lines on them and lots of long words on the packaging. It's a con, probably. Or not.
Did they keep your feet dry?
I didn't buy them.
Oh.
No. It's possible to spend £50, but I can't afford £50 socks. That's mad. All right, back to technology. Our first story this week, Microsoft HoloLens is now available in the UK for £2,179 if you're a developer, or £4,500 if you're a punter.
Well, slightly more for developer. It's £2,719, so it's not £2,179. Which is like £600 even more. Exactly, it's already extortionate.
It's preposterously expensive, but it's out, and Vicky, you've played around with it.
I have indeed. So America and Canada had it last year, as is usually the case. We get it quite late. It's still not available for consumers, which I'll just stress. So although it's available in the UK, it is only available for developers and for businesses to play with. And as you said, it's not cheap at all. So the thing that Microsoft try and stress a lot with HoloLens is that it's not a peripheral. So HTC Vive, Google Cardboard, Google Daydream, all those sorts of VR headsets all rely on you having a phone. Especially HTC Vive relies on you having a huge setup. Oculus Rift relies on you having a really expensive computer setup. Whereas HoloLens is designed, so yes, it's really expensive, but you don't have to buy anything else to go with it.
Okay, so that's the pitch from Microsoft. And that's what they're going to try and get commercial companies to spend $4,500 on. Is it any good?
Do you know what? So the demo videos, I was really impressed with. So actually, when we went to the Microsoft Hub, they turned their whole office into this holographic hub. And they took you through a number of different demos to try and showcase all the things that HoloLens can do. First one was life with holograms. So you go into a room, looks like a front room, and you can pick and choose from a store paintings or furniture, and you can drop it into your front room and you can see what it looks like. It's okay. The second demo was Case Western University. Now, this is the one I was most excited about because Microsoft made a big deal of this partnership with these medical students. What it does is you can look forward and you can see a whole skeleton, and you can do the air tap gesture, and you can suddenly strip away the skin, you can strip away the muscles, you can go right down to the bones, you can then see digestive tracts, you can see hearts beating. It's pretty overwhelming, actually, to look inside a heart that's beating. Obviously, it's not real, but to look inside and see things that obviously we're using every day right in front of your eyes, or like beamed onto the back of your eyes. The only problem is that as much as it did live up to the demo, it's really cool, you don't realise until you put the headset on how restrictive this headset actually is.
Right, so you say obviously it's not real. The idea with VR is it's meant to feel real, and particularly here where it's overlaying stuff onto the real world, but it didn't quite convince?
Well, that's the thing. They Microsoft made this big thing about how it's mixed reality. It's not virtual reality. It's not augmented reality. It's somewhere in between, which I think is just a lot of puff. But the problem is that you don't have a screen. So it's not like Google Glass where you've got a display that you're looking at. The images are actually beamed onto the back of your eye. So, and it uses the cameras to try and pick that up, and it uses sensors to work out where you're looking and track your gaze and all this sort of things, but you're only given a very small rectangle. So what happens is when you're looking at a skeleton, I quite wrongly assumed that you'd see the whole skeleton in front of you, but what you can only see is you can only see the part of the skeleton at the point where you're looking at in that rectangle.
So to see its feet, you have to look down at its feet,
and exaggeratedly so as well. So you have to put your whole head forward, your whole head back, and if you're trying to look up close, you sort of end up twisting your neck backwards and forwards and round to the side, and it just doesn't feel natural at all. I mean, your eyes dart around naturally, and this felt like it was being really, really restrictive.
And I suppose you kind of take it for granted, right? But the amount of information that we pick up from our periphery vision, so you can hold your hand at the side of your head and you know it's there, not unless you have a very unfortunate visual impairment, you don't see life through a letterbox.
No, exactly. And that's the thing that sort of they say in one respect you get transported into these mixed reality worlds, but you really don't, because you are consciously aware that this headset is on your head and it's quite heavy and you're moving your head in a certain way. So it's not quite as I actually think that VR headsets, so the Oculus and the HTC Vive, are better than this because it does immerse you. The whole point is that it does take you into another world.
But is this ever going to be available for consumers? I mean, it certainly seems like it's still a very, very early prototype.
So I asked Microsoft this, and they said part of the reason by giving it to businesses and to developers is, firstly, they want to actually see what the case uses are. They want to put it into the hands of businesses and see what it can be used for. Because their team and their development team have thought of ways it can be used, but until companies start using it, they don't actually know. In terms of developers, they've said to me that they don't want a consumer version being released until they've got enough apps to showcase its capabilities. So unless developers get to play with it and learn how to do it and then develop it, there's no point giving it to consumers, because you put this headset on, you go, oh, I can only do the two demos that Microsoft got and I haven't got anything else.
But yes or no, and use a few more words if you want, is the letterbox, very restricted vision thing a complete... Does it ruin it?
No, it depends what you're using it for. So I think in the Case Western University example, because you're looking at a very long skeleton, I think it's probably a unique case. When you're... What companies use, and NASA's using it, for example, and we did a Skype demo, that's when it comes into its own, really, because you only need that little window. When you call someone on Skype on your laptop or on your phone, you only have a very limited window, so it feels a lot more natural in that respect.
It's a lot of kit to put on for a Skype call, isn't it?
$4,500 worth to make a Skype call.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But the demo that they showed us was, and this is my favourite, actually, I made a Skype call with someone called Dave, who was a Microsoft employee, but I was in a house where the electrics are broken. So Dave was on Skype call with me and just said, okay, I can see everything that you can see, Vicky. To the left of you is a screwdriver. To the right of you is the wires. Put this wire in that slot and then press that button. And he guided me through actually fixing the electrics in this flat by annotating the screen, pointing to things, led me upstairs to where the fuse box was. And what's interesting about that is that again showcases that there's no wires. So a lot of complaints about HTC Vive and Oculus and stuff like that is you end up being tethered to something, whereas HoloLens, all the computer's built in. I still don't think it's worth £4,500 worth so you can walk around your house, but it's definitely, that is what separates it.
And it will be interesting to see, now that it is more generally available in the UK and it's been around for quite a while now in the US and Canada, what other businesses are developing stuff for it, and if it is going to go more down the route of industrial applications, like strapping it on when you need to go down and repair a sewer or an electricity mainframe, whatever the correct terminology would be. So it's a case of wait and see, I suppose. So from VR to AI, DeepMind's done something clever again, Matt Burgess.
They have. DeepMind, which is Google's basically AI company, has this week built a new neural network that has a memory, and it was able to train it to use the London Underground in a rational way.
Which no one can do, judging by rush hour on the Victoria line.
Yeah, it's pretty packed. But basically, exploring the tube isn't something that's very complicated. There are apps, there are lots of programs, there is lots of code out there that can do this, but they're all basically pre-programmed to do this. And Google has taught its neural network basically to do this. And for people that don't know, neural networks are a set of algorithms or computer code that are designed in the same way as the brain. They're designed to mimic how the brain works and actually just try and think in the same sort of way and actually create that sort of logical pattern.
So the distinction to understand here is that City Mapper can obviously navigate the London Underground because it has been told all the parameters. It's not really using a brain, it's just looking up data. It's not clever.
No, it's not clever.
Whereas DeepMind has no idea what an underground network is, no idea that it's trying to navigate. It's just told to work out the rules of the system it's given, and it does it, so like a human would.
Yeah, that's the big advancement here. And in most cases, neural networks, which have been used to basically beat Go, the game in Japan earlier this year.
South Korea. Yeah.
That sort of neural network has been able to learn these sort of things and has been able to explore the tube if it's given enough data, as you sort of say.
Yeah, so it's effectively doing it blind. But what's really, really clever here is they combined the neural network with a memory, which is something new.
Yes, that is what is actually new. So to use London Underground as a travel example, the researchers created a graph or model for the AI to be able to explore the underground. So they basically gave it the sort of data that it needs, and they only gave it once. And the data, the AI was basically then able to use this, retain it, and then if you showed it another system, for example, the Paris Metro, it would be able to find its way around this own different metro system using basically the structure that it's already had. So it's retained how it would do this exploration or this journey, and to state what is quite obviously it wasn't doing a journey around here. This was something that they created as like a hypothetical situation that it could do something in, just to like show off how this works and what the actual AI is capable of doing. It wasn't actually going around or providing answers. It's just an experiment just to so we can understand it, but it will be able to repeat this across different systems, different graphs, different, basically solving the same problem in a different location.
And the really exciting thing here is that obviously I can look at a metro map and understand the rules and conventions of navigating that map anywhere in the world, right? Just as I can understand that a kettle's turned on by flicking a switch, or kettles are slightly alike. But what an artificial intelligence can do is take a huge, huge, huge data set and recognize the rules of data sets and manipulate those in the similar way to a human being would manipulate a metro map.
Yeah, that is basically what the future for this sort of neural network is. And it's the first time they've developed a neural network that can actually retain a memory and keep it. They use quite a small data set in this case, but they actually said the data set would be able to be retained for basically an indefinite amount of time, so it could keep this data for as long as you wanted it to. But if you fed into it and scaled up the system so it had more processing power and had more computational skills to it, then it will be able to use bigger data sets. And this is where sort of the hope lies in this. If you feed it a massive data set with millions of rows, billions of entries even, then it could retain all these and actually apply what is learned from one situation and put it into something else that it hasn't seen before.
So what, I mean, obviously they use the London Underground as an example so that we would understand, but I mean, what's the point? Why are they doing this?
So it's basically to improve the AI, the neural network, so they can create a better neural network altogether in the end. So for a lot of people in artificial intelligence, the actual, the overall goal is to create a general learner, which is an artificial intelligence that can actually do anything, can answer any question, can go out and do any type of problem solving without having to be specifically told this is the sort of problem you're going out to do. So it can learn in a multiple different number of ways, it can recall data in different ways, it can go out and find data and basically operate autonomously. And being able to have a memory is a part of this. So if an AI network has seen something before and it's able to retain that, then it'll be able to learn from this in the future and actually be able to just apply its knowledge and its learnings and its methods to different types of data sets and different sets of data.
And the really big ideas here are kind of scary in a way. You imagine you have a city that's absolutely covered in sensors. Cities already are, and in the future they'll be even more so. You'd be able to hook an AI up to that, and it would be able to solve traffic congestion. It would be able to see patterns that humans can't. It would be able to think in a way that humans can't and interpret data in a way that humans can't. Just hook it up to the entire internet. Hook it up to a stock exchange where you already have trades being done artificially on on the international markets. So as this starts to scale up and they're able to think like us, but do so with huge, huge data sets, well, then you could start to see why people are afraid for their jobs.
Yeah, you could. And that's the point with this latest stuff that DeepMind have done, that it's working towards a bigger goal, and it's working to think the same way that humans actually operate and process thoughts and reasoning.
But without the stupidness.
Yeah, without the stupidness. Like, for example, with the London Underground thing, there are programs that are out there that do this already. And it seems quite a basic question to be saying, how do you get from A to B? But for a computer to be able to work out what the best way this is on its own without having the data set and millions of rows of data to go through and say, oh, we tried this way, but this didn't work. That's the thing that's really clever, that it's learning to do this and remembering to do it and can apply it to different situations.
Well, that was one of my favourite things about this story was that it's, you suddenly take for granted what we're capable of. So when they start breaking it down and go, a computer can do this, and this is like how a human thinks, you go, of course it's how a human thinks, but we're just so used to doing it that we don't even think about it. We take it for granted. And that's why I think what James was saying about it being quite scary is that people, humans, are making these computers which will then act like humans. So then what happens to the humans?
We all just sit around all day, right? Being served by our incredibly ingenious but subservient AI overlords.
And watching Black Mirror on Netflix.
That's a much better segue than I was going to do. I was trying to work out what I was going to say there. Yes, Black Mirror is back. This is Charlie Brooker's weird lens on the not-too-distant future. It used to be on Channel 4, but for Season 3, which comes out in a couple of weeks, it's going to Netflix, which means that it's launching in every single country in the world, apart from China and North Korea, simultaneously on October the 21st. A couple of weeks ago, I sat down with Charlie Brooker and executive producer Annabelle Jones to find out a bit about the series. And I think it's fair to say that they've got a bit more money this time and a bit more ambition and maybe a little bit more freedom to tell different kinds of stories.
I mean, let's just take it back, though. The first two series, they didn't hold back, did they? So, I mean, where on earth can Series 3 go that's beyond that?
I've seen four, so there's six episodes. I saw one of them last night, which is a feature length. It's nearly an hour and a half, which obviously you couldn't do on Channel 4. Well, you could, but it would be more difficult. You've got your hour-long slot, right? So the episodes vary in length. The feature length one is incredibly, incredibly, incredibly dark, and a couple of the other ones are darker still. But what they've also got, because they've got the budget, all the visual effects have got better. Some of the ideas that they're able to play around with are more ambitious and more technologically based. And this is a series that has a bizarre ability to predict fairly improbable events, shall we say.
That's one way of wording it.
Sort of David Cameron and a pig in the very first episode of the first season of Black Mirror sees the British Prime Minister compelled to have sex with a pig on live television. And what was it, 3 or 4 years after that debuted, allegations were made in a biography of David Cameron that he did something rather similar during his university days. And it's just incredible.
I mean, that's what amazes me. I think that's why it captures people's imagination, because in some respects, Black Mirror goes really far and it puts these scenarios in place that you think, oh, that never happened, and then they have done. But the way that Charlie Brooker writes it, it is so related to things that are around now, even if it's not directly. He really seems to tap into the Twitter psyche or how technology is developing in a way that no one else does. So you're watching it and it feels familiar, even though that it's meant to be this dystopian future. And I think that's why it captured everyone's imagination.
And I think he describes it as the future 5 minutes from now. So it's what's going to happen when you walk around the next corner. And it's interesting asking him, so because everyone's very obsessed with this idea that he's so good at predicting the future. So I asked him, well, do you spend lots of time on Reddit or RSS feeds for technology sites, scouring the internet, trying to find these weird bits of technology that you think would make good material for your TV show? And his answer is no, not at all. We don't look at technology in that way. We can come up with interesting human stories and then we sort of take them to their logical conclusion. So there's an episode from season two, the first episode of season two, Be Right Back, which is, in my opinion, the best episode of Black Mirror yet, which is where a social media network is able to bring the dead back to life. And shortly after that, lots of social media sites started introducing these legacy features where you could download profiles, and there's artificial intelligence systems that are trying to rebuild dead people from their social network profiles. This is actually happening. So you can kind of see his it's like a, it's a bit like a kind of a mind game, right? Think of something that's happening now and just fling your mind to a ridiculous, horrible conclusion and probably add some violence.
What about VR? How about that as a conclusion?
Well, someone at the screening that I went to last night asked him if he'd want to make Black Mirror in virtual reality.
Mean that a logical conclusion for VR.
Yeah, I know you want me to talk about that. Yeah, we'll get to that because it's just such a fun quote. So he said that virtual reality actually makes you feel sick, and he's not really sure of how you tell a story in VR, like the limitations that you were talking about, Vicky, with HoloLens, that you can't quite move around in the way you want to with your eyes or with your body, whatever it may be. Charlie Brooker said it just makes him feel sick, which is quite common. But I asked him, you know, where's VR going? Because this seems like quite a good subject for you to riff on in Black Mirror. And I think his response was something along the lines of, it will just be a load of teenage boys committing war atrocities and getting blowjobs in virtual reality forevermore.
Well.
Yeah. So there's that. I mean, and that's the good thing about him. He's not, quite a lot of people that we interview in this industry are very, very media trained. And even if they're not, they're quite careful with their words. And he's not, really. And that makes him quite a compelling person to talk to, and that's probably why his television show is such a success, because he's got free rein to do whatever he wants.
Well, that honesty comes through as well, doesn't it? Like when you're watching a series like that, that's what I mean about it feels familiar, even though it's this horrible futuristic conclusion. I mean, it's basically 2016. The way 2016 is going at the moment could just be one big Black Mirror.
Yeah, and he talked about some really interesting things that they'd like to do technically. So obviously moving from Channel 4 to Netflix gives them interesting technology to play with. So they didn't do it, but something that they're thinking about maybe doing in a future season, Netflix I think has signed on an additional 3 seasons, is say you watch House of Cards on Netflix or you live in Wisconsin, you'd be watching an episode of Black Mirror and you'd see a different version to someone else, or a character would make reference, or something on the screen would flash up to break down that fourth wall. The data's there, and if they were able to set up some way of technologically doing it, you could have alternate endings based on, if you really, really like romantic films, you'd see a more romantic ending. And then when you're talking about it to a friend, you suddenly realise that everyone's watched a different episode. It's clever. It's really, really clever. And that's kind of the way that he thinks. So, yeah. And it's good. It's really, really good. The interview is online. Wider.co.uk, and it's also in the latest issue of the magazine. I would have loved to have used some of the audio on the podcast, but sadly, the only place that I could speak to him was a very, very loud, echoey photographer's studio. So the audio is a bit useless. But you can read the interview, as I said, online and in the magazine. Coming up after the break, is your social media echo chamber hurting your brain?
This year, Wired launched the Wired Audi Innovation Awards to celebrate the people achieving extraordinary things, from AI to design and science to social innovation. The nominees have been decided, and the awards will be handed out at a ceremony on November 9th. To find out more, visit wired.co.uk, search for the hashtag Wired Audi Awards, and pick up the January issue of the magazine, where we'll be showcasing the work of the winners.
Welcome back. In the latest issue of Wired, we have an article in Ideas Bank by author William Poundstone, and he basically argues that aggregation is damaging your intelligence. It's, as he put it, depreciating your mind. So this is the idea that in the echo chamber of Facebook or Twitter, that you're missing out, that by collecting around agreeing people, you're missing something. And this seems very, very topical at the moment. So I wanted to explore the issue a little bit. We spoke about getting news through Facebook and Facebook's censorship of a war photograph a few weeks ago on the podcast. So we've kind of gone over this a little bit already. But do either of you feel like you're in an echo chamber?
I think that's a problem. You don't, because you're in it. You don't. It's not until someone highlights an article like this highlights it, where you suddenly look at your Twitter followers and who you're following, and you look at your Facebook friends, and you look at what's on your RSS feeds, and you suddenly realize, actually, this is all really similar.
But I kind of don't see the problem with it, right? So it's a bit like someone saying, oh, you should go down the pub with someone you hate.
Yeah.
Well, why would I want to do that? But on the other side, I can see, you know, you need debate, you need to hear different voices in order to get a better view of the world. And if everything that you see is what's published by the Daily Telegraph and the Mail and the Financial Times, say, then you will only get their editorial views, however broad they may be, right? So that's a bit of a problem. And there's also the problem of the networks that control this information, right? So Facebook tends towards things that are positive. You like things. You love things.
But I mean, Mark Zuckerberg even came out and said, we're not a publisher. We don't do this. But they are. Facebook is. It controls it with its trending news, in the way that its algorithm sorts out what you see and what is shown to you on sponsored posts. It's based on cookies. It's based on what your friends like. It's based on what you liked 3 months ago. It's based on who you speak to. They are controlling what you are seeing. So maybe they're not a publisher in the traditional sense, but they are. You can't deny that.
It's a bit like saying Spotify is not a DJ, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The idea that when we were growing up, you found new music by listening to the radio, people recommending stuff, walking through a record store and fumbling through all the tapes and CDs or whatever it may be, and finding something based on the artwork or recommendation of someone. Whereas now, however clever the algorithms are, if all you listen to is hip-hop...
Drake.
If all you listen to is Drake, it's only going to recommend really, really similar things. Not that I'm sure there's anything quite like Drake in the entire world, right?
There's nothing quite like Drake.
Nothing quite like Drake. Do you feel that you're in an echo chamber, Matt?
I think so, yes. I think there's two areas of this for me that we briefly mentioned, but they are the really pertinent ones. There's who we choose to listen to consciously, so who we choose to follow, who we choose to be friends with on Facebook, and then they will obviously give us a very similar view, because if I follow people that only talk about, say, right-wing views, for example, I'm only going to get right-wing views and see right-wing opinions. And then there's also the other side of it, which is the side of it, which is the stuff that we don't really choose, which is the curated, the algorithm-driven side of things, which are feeding up through a stuff which is either maybe selected by what's popular elsewhere, what's popular with the people we know, or basically stuff that isn't consciously decided by us.
Yeah, but there's so much stuff out there, right? And that's a problem as well. So I was looking through my Twitter feed a few weeks ago, and my partner pointed out that everyone on there was just posting links to The Guardian and The New Statesman and The New York Times, and et cetera, et cetera. So I went, okay, well, I can maybe start to do something about this. So I started to read more things in The Telegraph, more things in The Financial Times, more things in The Economist, which admittedly isn't expanding my horizons much beyond British institutional journalism, but is giving me slightly different worldviews. But then that's the other thing. You don't have to stay in the echo chamber, right? If you want to follow completely random people on Twitter or Facebook, well, less so Facebook, you can. If you want to add a random political opinion site to your RSS feed, you can. If you the internet is open, it's all there for you. It's just that at the moment, people in quite an unsophisticated way, I guess, and this is all new to us, right? People just click on what they like.
Well, that's what the article by William Poundstone talks about, is that they did some studies or some surveys, and they worked out that new media users, to use that word that I don't particularly like, but new media users are less informed than people who like going to TV and like listening to the radio and things like that. But the point that it makes in the article is that there's still someone controlling the radio. There's still someone controlling the TV. So it might make you more knowledgeable in some respects, because you're not maybe narrowing it down, or that the algorithms aren't narrowing it down for you, but you're still getting someone else's viewpoint. The editor of that show or that radio, the TV show or the radio show, is still deciding what it classifies as news. And in this day and age, where you've got so much data so you can work out what people are liking, the editor may be making a decision, but they'll be making a decision based on what someone liked last week. So although this article is saying that actually it's better to probably listen to radio and watch TV, I'm not convinced that it is, because you still have this problem. It just doesn't seem quite so nuanced.
Yeah. Ultimately, I suppose, it's who's the editor, right? Online, to an extent, you're the editor. You get to choose what is in your daily digest. Whereas if you just sit down and watch CNN, then CNN decides what's in your daily digest. And why they might be more qualified to tell you what's important, you're a better knower of yourself. Which I guess is why we collapse into the echo chamber, right? But there's a flip side to this, that you kind of have this culture of sharing and liking and being surrounded by people that you agree with, but it's also led to, inevitably, news sites and kind of a culture of extremes. So you have sites like Breitbart and The Canary, which are kind of lashing out at these echo chamber-ish publications, right? So if you can't find what you want on The Guardian, well, maybe you slide into The Canary. If you can't find what you want on The Daily Mail, maybe you head to Breitbart. So that's the other side of it. And that echo chamber, once you go very far left or very far right, can potentially be more dangerous.
Well, especially with the Brexit vote. I remember being on Twitter, and a lot of the people that I follow were Remain. A lot of people wanted to stay in the EU. And you sort of assume that that's how everyone thinks, because that's what you're seeing all the time. And it wasn't until I sort of went to Goodwood Festival of Speed, and I'm driving through some villages, and there were a lot of Leave posters, and I realised how actually the Leave campaign had captured that imagination. But because I lived in this bubble in London where a lot of people Remain, and that was the strong viewpoint, I just assumed that that was the rest of the country.
All those 50-year-olds weren't on Twitter.
But that also, if I'm looking at that going, okay, I'm in London, and my default reaction is to assume that, okay, everyone on Twitter's talking about it, so maybe the whole country feels like this. You spread that out over globally, and it's actually quite terrifying to think that if people are making those assumptions, like I was, wrongly, that suddenly you have this view of the world. So it's not even about specifics. You suddenly have a view of the world that it is very X, Y, or Z.
Well, without wanting to get too deeply philosophical, right? Everyone views the world through a lens, and it's somewhat foolhardy to think that when presented with all the information in the world that you'd somehow be able to make a non-biased selection of that information. I go back to the point, you don't go to the pub with people that you hate. And so, yes, there's an echo chamber. Yes, people need to be more aware of it. And I think that as we use social media more and more, and maybe Facebook starts to change its algorithms, and Mark Zuckerberg admits he is a publisher, he is an editor in a way, that this will become more sophisticated and more nuanced than like.
Well, I think that's, if you take the politics side away, if you are just looking at your general interests, so if you are interested in a certain singer like Drake, or you're interested in certain hiking socks and stuff like that,
I am interested in certain hiking socks.
But if you those don't do any harm. But I think what the point that you just made is absolute key, is that you just need to be aware of it. So as long as you are aware that sometimes your Google results are going to be personalised, you're not seeing the same thing as someone else. But it goes back to the Black Mirror stuff. If they're thinking about giving you alternate endings, suddenly everything you consume will be personalised to you.
I think that there is a problem there when going forward, and there needs to be some accountability around the algorithms that make these decisions. Because if I'm watching Netflix and all it ever recommends to me is stuff that is maybe vaguely similar to what I've watched before, where is my freedom of choice coming into this? Am I just going to get into a stage where I'm used to saying, used to trusting the computer or the algorithms that are doing this and saying, yes, I'll watch this. Yes, I'll watch this next one that is related to this. Like, when as a society are we going to be at this point where we say questioning what is being presented to us as a choice from a computer? And I think that's starting to happen, and people are starting to think about what they are actually consuming and what's being given to us and fed to us by algorithms. But there's just not a lot of transparency around what algorithms do and how they work and who's controlling them.
Here's sort of a counterpoint to that. So in William Pounson's article that we're kind of inspired to talk about this, it's in Ideas Bank in the latest issue of Wired, he compares Times users, people that read the Times versus people that read or use Tumblr, and suggests that people that read the Times are better informed about the world than people that use Tumblr. And it's the suggestion that there's a generational thing, right? People who use new media are somehow dumber than people who use old media, because at the end of the day, the people that curate old media are seen as very clever, very well informed, and have a lot of experience to call on.
But the problem that I had with that statement in the piece is that suggests that they're mutually exclusive. That suggests that if you read the Times, you can't use Tumblr. There are thousands, millions of people who will probably do both. And it suddenly starts narrowing it down a little bit. Suddenly it then puts you into these little boxes. and it says, oh, you read the Times, so you're really well informed, but oh, you use Tumblr, so does that mean you're a little bit less informed? Like, that's the problem that I had with that piece.
So having talked about this, not a huge amount of length, but a little bit of length, and it's something that I've been thinking about for quite a while, we all agree, I think, that we're in some kind of echo chamber, but are you going to go away and do anything about it?
I think Spotify, I certainly do, because I actually get bored of the same type of music. So Spotify last year did their all the songs you've listened to over 2015, and it tried to sort of rank. It had, like, you know, their personalised little graphs that they give you. So Drake was obviously really high, because I do really love Drake, but also McFly was in there. And
interesting.
And David Bowie and Paul Weller and The Jam. And suddenly my music taste is a lot more eclectic than just one person. So I will actively go and seek out alternatives. And that's why Spotify does try and counteract that by having their browse playlist. And if that develops, then I think maybe we won't be stuck in this echo chamber for as long as we think we might be.
I can't see myself doing much about it, to be honest. I think that in a lot of cases, especially with the new media, as we've put it out there, in terms of news and political opinions and things like that, I very much follow the people that I'm very interested in and only have the time to read stuff that they write, or only interested in the opinions that they write, because I know that generally I agree with them, which I know is in this cycle of reinforcement and actually doing this and not challenging and broadening views. But in a world where we're having less and less time to do things, then I would in some cases like to read things and speak to the people and communicate with the people that I agree with. I don't think it's necessarily the right thing to be doing, but am I going to consciously go out, and a lot of people are going to consciously go out and actively go somewhere that they don't go to read an article? Probably not.
Out of their comfort zone as well, isn't it? A lot of people are afraid to do that because suddenly you read someone else's viewpoint and you might suddenly skew, but you've had this viewpoint for 32 years or whatever it is, and suddenly you think, oh no, this, and so it suddenly becomes either, it'll go either way. You'll either be a bit open-minded and go, okay, I'll take that on board, or actually it will entrench your view because you go, well, that's definitely not how I feel, my view must be correct, and it could even make it worse.
You've just summed up the internet, I think. So I think I'm going to resolve to go down the pub and have more drunken arguments with strangers, which is probably a good idea for all of us. And on that note, we will see you again next week. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.